with him. But by ignoring Carlos, the teacher had in effect written him off. She was implying that he was not worth bothering with. At least that was the message the other kids got. If the teacher wasn't calling on Carlos, it must be because Carlos is stupid. It is likely that Carlos himself came to the same conclusion. Naturally, Carlos was quite uncomfortable with the new system, which required him to talk to his groupmates. He had a great deal of trouble communicating his paragraph. He stammered, hesitated, and fidgeted. The other kids were not helpful at all. They reacted out of their old, overlearned habit. When a kid stumbles, especially one they think is stupid, they resort to ridicule and teasing. "Aw, you don't know it," accused Mary. "You're dumb. You're stupid. You don't know what you're doing." One of us, assigned to observe the group process, would intervene with a bit of advice when she overheard such comments. "Okay, you can tease him if you want to," she said, "and that might be fun for you, but it's not going to help you learn about Joseph Pulitzer's middle years. The exam will take place in about an hour." Notice how she changed the reinforcement contingencies. Now Mary doesn't gain much from putting Carlos down, and she stands to lose a great deal. After a few days and several such experiences, it began to dawn on these kids that the only chance they had to learn about Carlos's segment was by paying attention to what Carlos had to say. And with that realization, the kids began to develop into pretty good interviewers, sort of junior Dick Cavett's. Instead of teasing Carlos or ignoring him, they learned to draw him out, to ask the questions that made it easier for him to explain out loud what was in his head. Carlos, in turn, relaxed more, and this improved his ability to communicate. After a couple of weeks, the children concluded that Carlos wasn't nearly as dumb as they thought he was. They saw things in him they hadn't seen before. They began to like him more, and Carlos began to enjoy school more and think of his Anglo classmates not as tormentors, but as friends. There is a tendency when faced with positive results like those from the jigsaw classroom to become overly enthusiastic about a single, simple solution to a tenacious problem. Experience should tell us that such problems rarely yield to a simple remedy. That is no doubt true in this case as well. Even within the boundaries of cooperative learning procedures, the issues are complex. Before we can feel truly comfortable with the jigsaw or any similar approach to learning and liking, much more research is needed to determine how frequently, in what size doses, at which ages, and in which sorts of groups cooperative strategies will work. We also need to know the best way for teachers to institute new methods, provided they will institute them at all. After all, not only are cooperative learning techniques a radical departure from the traditional, familiar routine of most teachers, they may also threaten the teacher's sense of importance in the classroom by turning over much of the instruction to the students. Finally, we must realize that competition has its place too. It can serve as a valuable motivator of desirable action and an important builder of self-concept. The task then is not to eliminate academic competition, but to break its monopoly in the classroom by introducing regular cooperative successes that include members of all ethnic groups. Despite these qualifications, I cannot help but be encouraged by the evidence to date. When I talk to my students or even my neighbors and friends about the prospects for cooperative learning approaches, I can feel optimism rise in me. The public schools have for so long been the source of discouraging news, sinking test scores, teacher burnout, increasing crime, and of course, racial conflict. Now there is at least one crack in the gloom, and I find myself genuinely excited about it. What's the point of this digression into the effects of school desegregation on race relations? The point is to make two points. First, although the familiarity produced by contact usually leads to greater liking, the opposite occurs if the contact carries distasteful experiences with it. Therefore, when children of different racial groups are thrown into the incessant, harsh competition of the standard American classroom, we ought to see, and we do see, the worsening of hostilities. Second, the evidence that team-oriented learning is an antidote to this disorder may tell us about the heavy impact of cooperation on the liking process. But before we assume that cooperation is a powerful cause of liking, we should first pass it through what, to my mind, is the acid test. Do compliance practitioners systematically use cooperation to get us to like them so we will say yes to their requests? Do they point it out when it exists naturally in a situation? Do they try to amplify it when it exists only weakly? And most instructive of all, do they manufacture it when it is absent? As it turns out, cooperation passes the test with colors flying. Compliance professionals are forever attempting to establish that we and they are working for the same goals, that we must pull together for mutual benefit, that they are, in essence, our teammates. A host of examples is possible. Most are familiar, like the new car salesman who takes our side and does battle with his boss to secure us a good deal. But one rather spectacular illustration occurs in a setting few of us would recognize firsthand because the professionals are police interrogators whose job is to induce suspects to confess to crime. In recent years, the courts have imposed a variety of restrictions on the way police must behave in handling suspected criminals, especially in seeking confessions. Many procedures that in the past led to admissions of guilt can no longer be employed for fear that they will result in a judge's dismissal of the case. As yet, however, the courts have found nothing illegal in the use by the police of subtle psychology. For this reason, criminal interrogations have taken increasingly to the use of such ploys as the one they call good cop, bad cop. Good cop, bad cop works as follows. A young robbery suspect, let's say, who has been advised of his rights and is maintaining his innocence, is brought to a room to be questioned by a pair of officers. One of the officers, either because the part suits him or because it is merely his turn, plays the role of bad cop. Before the suspect even sits down, bad cop curses the son of a bitch for the robbery. For the rest of the session, his words come only with snarls and growls. He kicks the prisoner's chair to emphasize his points. When he looks at the man, he seems to see a mound of garbage. If the suspect challenges bad cop's accusations or just refuses to answer them, bad cop becomes livid. His rage soars. He swears he will do everything possible to assure a maximum sentence. He says he has friends in the district attorney's office who will hear from him of the suspect's non-cooperative attitude and who will prosecute the case hard. At the outset of bad cop's performance, his partner, good cop, sits in the background. Then, slowly, he starts to chip in. First, he speaks only to bad cop, trying to temper the burgeoning anger. "Calm down, Frank, calm down." But bad cop shouts back, "Don't tell me to calm down when he's lying right to my face. I hate these lying bastards." A bit later, good cop actually says something in the suspect's behalf. "Take it easy, Frank, he's only a kid." Not much in the way of support, but compared to the rantings of bad cop, the words fall like music on the prisoner's ears. Still, bad cop is unconvinced. "Kid, he's no kid, he's a punk. That's what he is, a punk. And I'll tell you something else, he's over 18, and that's all I need to get his ass sent so far behind bars they'll need a flashlight to find him." Now good cop begins to speak directly to the young man, calling him by his first name and pointing out any positive details of the case. "I'll tell you, Kenny, you're lucky that nobody was hurt and you weren't armed. When you come up for sentencing, that'll look good." If the suspect persists in claiming innocence, bad cop launches into another tirade of curses and threats. But this time, good cop stops him. "Okay, Frank," handing bad cop some money. "I think we could all use some coffee. How about getting us 3 cups? When bad cop is gone, it's time for good cop's big scene. "Look, man, I don't know why, but my partner doesn't like you, and he's going to try to get you. And he's going to be able to do it because we've got enough evidence right now. And he's right about the DA's office going hard on guys who don't cooperate. You're looking at 5 years, man, 5 years. Now, I don't want to see that happen to you, so if you admit you robbed that place right now before he gets back, I'll take charge of your case and put in a good word for you to the DA. If we work together on this, we can cut that 5 years down to 2, maybe 1. Do us both a favor, Kenny, Just tell me how you did it, and then let's start working on getting you through this. A full confession frequently follows. Good cop, bad cop works as well as it does for several reasons. The fear of long incarceration is quickly instilled by bad cop's threats. The perceptual contrast principle ensures that, compared to the raving, venomous bad cop, the interrogator playing good cop will seem like an especially reasonable and kind man. And because good cop has intervened repeatedly on the suspect's behalf, has even spent his own money for a cup of coffee, the reciprocity rule pressures for a return favor. The big reason that the technique is effective, though, is that it gives the suspect the idea that there is someone on his side, someone with his welfare in mind, someone working together with him, for him. In most situations, such a person would be viewed very favorably, but in the deep trouble our robbery suspect finds himself, that person takes on the character of a savior. And from savior, it is but a short step to trusted father confessor. Conditioning and association. Why do they blame me, Doc? It was the shaky telephone voice of a local TV weatherman. He had been given my number when he called the psychology department at my university to find someone who could answer his question. A question that had always puzzled him but had recently begun to bother and depress him. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? Everybody knows that I just report the weather, that I don't order it, right? So how come I get so much flack when the weather's bad? During the floods last year, I got hate mail. One guy threatened to shoot me if it didn't stop raining. Christ, I'm still looking over my shoulder from that one. And the people I work with at the station do it too, sometimes right on the air. They'll zing me about a heat wave or something. They have to know that I'm not responsible, but that doesn't seem to stop them. Can you help me understand this, Doc? It's really getting me down. We made an appointment to talk in my office, where I tried to explain that he was the victim of an age-old click-whirr response that people have to things they perceive as merely connected to one another. Instances of this response abound in modern life. But I felt that the example most likely to help the distressed weatherman would require a bit of ancient history. I asked him to consider the precarious fate of the imperial messengers of old Persia. Any such messenger assigned the role of military courier had special cause to hope mightily for Persian battlefield successes. With news of victory in his pouch, he would be treated as a hero upon his arrival at the palace. The food, drink, and women of his choice were provided gladly and sumptuously. Should his message tell of military disaster, though, the reception would be quite different. He was summarily slain. I hoped that the point of this story would not be lost on the weatherman. I wanted him to be aware of a fact that is as true today as it was in the time of ancient Persia, or, for that matter, in the time of Shakespeare, who captured the essence of it with one vivid line. The nature of bad news, he said, infects the teller. There is a natural human tendency to dislike a person who brings us unpleasant information, even when that person did not cause the bad news. The simple association with it is enough to stimulate our dislike. But there was something else I hoped the weatherman would get from the historical examples. Not only was he joined in his predicament by centuries of other tellers, but also compared to some, such as the Persian messengers, he was very well off. At the end of our session, he said something to convince me that he appreciated this point quite clearly. "Doc," he said on his way out, "I feel a lot better about my job now. I mean, I'm in Phoenix where the sun shines 300 days a year, right? Thank God I don't do the weather in Buffalo." The weatherman's parting comment reveals that he understood more than I had told him about the principle that was influencing his viewers' liking for him. Being connected with bad weather does have a negative effect. But on the other side of the coin, being connected with sunshine should do wonders for his popularity. And he was right. The principle of association is a general one, governing both negative and positive connections. An innocent association with either bad things or good things will influence how people feel about us. Weathermen pay price for Nature's Curveballs. By David L. Lankford, Associated Press. Television weather forecasters make a good living talking about the weather, but when Mother Nature throws a curveball, they duck for cover. Conversations with several veteran prognosticators across the country this week turned up stories of them being whacked by old ladies with umbrellas, accosted by drunks in bars, pelted with snowballs and galoshes, threatened with death, and accused of trying to play God. I had one guy call and tell me that if it snowed over Christmas, I wouldn't live to see New Year's, said Bob Gregory, who has been the forecaster at WTHR-TV in Indianapolis for 9 years. Most of the forecasters claimed they are accurate 80% to 90% of the time on one-day forecasts, but longer-range predictions get tricky. And most conceded they are simply reporting information supplied by computers and anonymous meteorologists from the National Weather Service, or a private agency. But it's the face on the television screen that people go after. Tom Bonner, 35, who has been with KARK-TV in Little Rock, Arkansas for 11 years, remembers the time a burly farmer from Lone Oak, with too much to drink, walked up to him in a bar, poked a finger in his chest, and said, "You're the one that sent that tornado and tore my house up. I'm going to take your head off." Bonner said he looked for the bouncer, couldn't spot him, and replied, "That's right about the tornado, and I'll tell you something else. I'll send another one if you don't back off." Several years ago, when a major flood left water 10 feet deep in San Diego's Mission Valley, Mike Ambrose of KGTV recalls that a woman walked up to his car, whacked the windshield with an umbrella, and said, "This rain is your fault." Chuck Whitaker of WSBT-TV in South Bend, Indiana, says, "One little old lady called the police department and wanted the weatherman arrested for bringing all the snow. A woman, upset that it had rained for her daughter's wedding, called Tom Jawls of WKBW-TV in Buffalo, New York, to give him a piece of her mind. She held me responsible and said if she ever met me, she would probably hit me," he said. Sonny Elliott of WJBK-TV, a forecaster in the Detroit area for 30 years, recalls predicting 2 to 4 inches of snow in the city several years ago, and more than 8 came down. To retaliate, his colleagues at the station set up a contraption that rained about 200 galoshes on him while he was giving the forecast the next day. "I've still got the lumps to prove it," he says. Our instruction in how the negative association works seems to have been primarily undertaken by the mothers of our society. Remember how they were always warning us against playing with the bad kids down the street? Remember how they said it didn't matter if we did nothing bad ourselves because, in the eyes of the neighborhood, we would be known by the company we kept? Our mothers were teaching us about guilt by association. They were giving us a lesson in the negative side of the principle of association, and they were right. People do assume that we have the same personality traits as our friends. As for the positive associations, it is the compliance professionals who teach the lesson. They are incessantly trying to connect themselves or their products with the things we like. Did you ever wonder what all those good-looking models are doing standing around in the automobile ads? What the advertiser hopes they are doing is lending their positive traits, beauty and desirability, to the cars. The advertiser is betting that we will respond to the product in the same ways we respond to the attractive models merely associated with it. And they are right. In one study, men who saw a new car ad that included a seductive young woman model rated the car as faster, more appealing, more expensive looking, and better designed than did men who viewed the same ad without the model. Yet when asked later, the men refused to believe that the presence of the young woman had influenced their judgments. Because the association principle works so well, and so unconsciously, manufacturers regularly rush to connect their products with the current cultural rage. During the days of the first American moonshot, everything from breakfast drink to deodorant was sold with allusions to the U.S. space program. In Olympiad years, we are told precisely which is the official hairspray and facial tissue of our Olympic teams. During the 1970s, when the magic cultural concept appeared to be naturalness, the natural bandwagon was crowded to capacity. Sometimes the connections to naturalness didn't even make sense. "Change your hair color naturally," urged one popular TV commercial. The linking of celebrities to products is another way advertisers cash in on the association principle. Professional athletes are paid to connect themselves to things that can be directly relevant to their roles. Sports shoes, tennis rackets, golf balls, or wholly irrelevant, soft drinks, popcorn poppers, pantyhose. The important thing for the advertiser is to establish the connection. It doesn't have to be a logical one, just a positive one. Of course, popular entertainers provide another form of desirability that manufacturers have always paid dearly to tie to their goods. But recently, politicians have caught on to the ability of a celebrity linkage to sway voters. Presidential candidates assemble stables of well-known non-political figures who either actively participate in the campaign or merely lend their names to it. Even at the state and local level, a similar game is played. Take as evidence the comment of a Los Angeles woman I overheard expressing her conflicting feelings about a California referendum to limit smoking in public places. "It's a real tough decision. They've got big stars speaking for it, and big stars speaking against it. You don't know how to vote." If politicians are relative newcomers to the use of celebrity endorsements, they are old hands at exploiting the association principle in other ways. For example, congressional representatives traditionally announce to the press the start of federal projects that will bring new jobs or benefits to their home states. This is true even when a representative has had nothing to do with advancing the project, or has in some cases voted against it. While politicians have long strained to associate themselves with the values of motherhood, country, and apple pie, it may be in the last of these connections, to food, that they have been most clever. For instance, it is White House tradition to try to sway the votes of balking legislators over a meal. It can be a picnic lunch, a sumptuous breakfast, or an elegant dinner, but when an important bill is up for grabs, out comes the silverware. And political fundraising these days regularly involves the presentation of food. Notice, too, that at the typical fundraising dinner, the speeches, the appeals for further contributions, and heightened effort never come before the meal is served, only during or after. The advantages to this pairing of the affairs of the table with those of the state are several. For example, time is saved and the reciprocity rule is engaged. The least recognized benefit, however, may be the one uncovered in research conducted in the 1930s by the distinguished psychologist Gregory Razrin. Using what he termed the luncheon technique, he found that his subjects became fonder of the people and things they experienced while they were eating. In the example most relevant for our purposes, Razrin's subjects were presented with some political statements they had rated once before. At the end of the experiment, after all the political statements had been presented, Razrin found that only certain of them had gained an approval, those that had been shown while food was being eaten. And these changes in liking seemed to have occurred unconsciously, since the subjects could not remember which of the statements they had seen during the food service. How did Razrin come up with the luncheon technique? What made him think it would work? The answer may lie in the dual scholarly roles he played during his career. Not only was he a respected independent researcher, he was also one of the earliest translators into English of the pioneering psychological literature of Russia. It was a literature dedicated to the study of the association principle and dominated by the thinking of a brilliant man, Ivan Pavlov. Although a scientist of varied and elaborated talent, he had, for instance, won a Nobel Prize years earlier for his work on the digestive system. Pavlov's most important experimental demonstration was simplicity itself. He showed that he could get an animal's typical response to food, salivation, to be directed towards something irrelevant to food, a bell, merely by connecting the two things in the animal's mind. If the presentation of food to a dog was always accompanied by the sound of a bell, Soon the dog would salivate to the bell alone, even when there was no food to be had. It was not a long step from Pavlov's classic demonstration to Razrin's luncheon technique. Obviously, a normal reaction to food can be transferred to some other thing through the process of raw association. Razrin's insight was that there are many normal responses to food besides salivation, one of them being a good and favorable feeling. Therefore, it is possible to attach this pleasant feeling, this positive attitude, to anything, political statements being only an example, that is closely associated with good food. Nor is there a long step from the luncheon technique to the compliance professional's realization that all kinds of desirable things can substitute for food in lending their likable qualities to the ideas, products, and people artificially linked to them. In the final analysis, then, that is why those good-looking models are standing around in the magazine ads, and that is why radio programmers are instructed to insert the station's call letters jingle immediately before a big hit song is played. And that is even why the women playing barnyard bingo at a Tupperware party must yell the word Tupperware rather than bingo before they can rush to the center of the floor for a prize. It may be Tupperware for the women, but it's bingo for the company. Just because we are often the unaware victims of compliance practitioners' use of the association principle doesn't mean that we don't understand how it works or don't use it ourselves. There is ample evidence, for instance, that we understand fully the predicament of a Persian imperial messenger or modern-day weatherman announcing bad news. In fact, we can be counted on to take steps to avoid putting ourselves in any similar positions. Research done at the University of Georgia shows just how we operate when faced with the task of communicating good or bad news. Students waiting for an experiment to begin were given the job of informing a fellow student that an important phone call had come in for him. Half the time the call was supposed to bring good news and half the time bad news. The researchers found that the students conveyed the information very differently depending on its quality. When the news was positive, the tellers were sure to mention that feature. You just got a phone call with great news. Better see the experimenter for the details. But when the news was unfavorable, they kept themselves apart from it. You just got a phone call. Better see the experimenter for the details. Obviously, the students had previously learned that to be liked, they should connect themselves to good news, but not bad news. A lot of strange behavior can be explained by the fact that people understand the association principle well enough to strive to link themselves to positive events and separate themselves from negative events, even when they have not caused the events. Some of the strangest of such behavior takes place in the great arena of sports. The actions of the athletes are not the issue here, though. After all, in the heated contact of the game, they are entitled to an occasional eccentric outburst. Instead, it is the often raging, irrational, boundless fervor of the sports fan that seems on its face so puzzling. How can we account for wild sports riots in Europe, or the murder of players and referees by South American soccer crowds gone berserk, or the unnecessary lavishness of the gifts provided by local fans to already wealthy American ballplayers on the special day set aside to honor them? Rationally, none of this makes sense. It's just a game, isn't it? Hardly. The relationship between sport and the earnest fan is anything but game-like. It is serious, intense, and highly personal. An apt illustration comes from one of my favorite anecdotes. It concerns a World War II soldier who returned to his home in the Balkans after the war and shortly thereafter stopped speaking. Medical examinations could find no physical cause for the problem. There was no wound, no brain damage, no vocal impairment. He could read, write, understand a conversation, and follow orders, yet he would not talk. Not for his doctors, not for his friends, not even for his pleading family. Perplexed and exasperated, his doctors moved him to another city and placed him in a veterans' hospital, where he remained for 30 years, never breaking his self-imposed silence, and sinking into a life of social isolation. Then one day, a radio in his ward happened to be tuned to a soccer match between his hometown team and a traditional rival. When at a crucial point of play, the referee called a foul against a player from the man's home team, the mute veteran jumped from his chair, glared at the radio, and spoke his first words in more than three decades. "You dumbass," he cried. "Are you trying to give them the match?" With that, he returned to his chair and to a silence he never again violated. There are two important lessons to be derived from this true story. The first concerns the sheer power of the phenomenon. The veteran's desire to have his hometown team succeed was so strong that it alone produced a deviation from his solidly entrenched way of life. Similar effects of sports events on the long-standing habits of fans are far from unique to the back wards of veterans' hospitals. During the 1980 Winter Olympics, after the U.S. hockey team had upset the vastly favored Soviet team, the teetotaling father of the American goaltender, Jim Craig, was offered a flask. "I've never had a drink in my life," he reported later, "but someone behind me handed me cognac. I drank it. Yes, I did." Nor was such unusual behavior unique to parents of the players. Fans outside the hockey arena were described in news accounts as delirious. They hugged, sang, and turned somersaults in the snow. Even those fans not present at Lake Placid exulted in the victory and displayed their pride with bizarre behavior. In Raleigh, North Carolina, a swim meet had to be halted when, after the hockey score was announced, the competitors and audience alike chanted "USA, USA" until they were hoarse. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a quiet supermarket erupted at the news into a riot of flying toilet tissue and paper towel streamers. The customers were joined in their spree and soon led by the market employees and manager. Without question, the force is deep and sweeping. But if we return to the account of the silent veteran, we can see that something else is revealed about the nature of the union of sports and sports fan, something crucial to its basic character. It is a personal thing. Whatever fragment of an identity that ravaged mute man still possessed was engaged by soccer play. No matter how weakened his ego may have become after 30 years of wordless stagnation in a hospital ward, it was involved in the outcome of the match. Why? Because he personally would be diminished by a hometown defeat. How? Through the principle of association. The mere connection of birthplace hooked him, wrapped him, tied him to the approaching triumph or failure. As distinguished author Isaac Asimov put it in describing our reactions to the contests we view, all things being equal, you root for your own sex, your own culture, your own locality, and what you want to prove is that you are better than the other person. Whomever you root for represents you, and when he wins, you win. When viewed in this light, the passion of the sports fan begins to make sense. The game is no light diversion to be enjoyed for its inherent form or artistry. The self is at stake. That is why hometown crowds are so adoring and, more tellingly, so grateful toward those regularly responsible for home team victories. That is also why the same crowds are often ferocious in their treatment of players, coaches, and officials implicated in athletic failures. Fans' intolerance of defeat can shorten the careers of even successful players and coaches. Take the case of Frank Layden, who abruptly quit as coach of the NBA's Utah Jazz while the team was leading the league's Midwest division. Layden's relative success, warm humor, and widely known charitable activities in the Salt Lake City area were not enough to shield him from the ire of some Jazz supporters after team losses. Citing a brace of incidents with abusive fans, including one in which people waited around for an hour to curse at him following a defeat, Layden explained his decision. "Sometimes in the NBA you feel like a dog. I've had people spit on me. I had a guy come up to me and say, 'I'm a lawyer. Hit me so I can sue you.' I think America takes all sports too seriously." so we want our affiliated sports teams to win to prove our own superiority. But to whom are we trying to prove it? Ourselves, certainly, but to everyone else, too. According to the association principle, if we can surround ourselves with success that we are connected with in even a superficial way, for example, place of residence, our public prestige will rise. Are sports fans right to think that without ever throwing a block, catching a ball, scoring a goal, or perhaps even attending a game, they will receive some of the glory from a hometown championship? I believe so. The evidence is in their favor. Recall that Persia's messengers did not have to cause the news. My weatherman did not have to cause the weather. And Pavlov's bell did not have to cause the food for powerful effects to occur. The association was enough. It is for this reason that, were the University of Southern California to win the Rose Bowl, we could expect people with a Southern Cal connection to try to increase the visibility of that connection in any of a variety of ways. In one experiment showing how wearing apparel can serve to proclaim such an association, researchers counted the number of school sweatshirts worn on Monday mornings by students on the campuses of 7 prominent football universities: Arizona State, Louisiana State, Notre Dame, Michigan, Ohio State, Pittsburgh, and Southern California. The results showed that many more homeschool shirts were worn if the football team had won its game on the prior Saturday. What's more, the larger the margin of victory, the more such shirts appeared. It wasn't a close, hard-fought game that caused the students to dress themselves, literally, in success. Instead, it was a clear, crushing conquest, smacking of indisputable superiority. This tendency to try to bask in reflected glory by publicly trumpeting our connections to successful others has its mirror image in our attempt to avoid being darkened by the shadow of others' defeat. In an amazing display during the luckless 1980 season, season ticket-holding fans of the New Orleans Saints football team began to appear at the stadium wearing paper bags to conceal their faces. As their team suffered loss after loss, more and more fans donned the bags until TV cameras were regularly able to record the extraordinary image of gathered masses of people shrouded in brown paper, with nothing to identify them but the tips of their noses. I find it instructive that during a late-season contest, when it was clear that the Saints were at last going to win one, the fans discarded their bags and went public once more. All this tells me that we purposefully manipulate the visibility of our connections with winners and losers in order to make ourselves look good to anyone who could view these connections. By showcasing the positive associations and burying the negative ones, we are trying to get observers to think more highly of us and to like us more. There are many ways we go about this, but one of the simplest and most pervasive is in the pronouns we use. Have you noticed, for example, how often after a home team victory, fans crowd under the range of a TV camera, thrust their index fingers high, and shout, "We're number one! We're number one!" Note that the call is not, "They're number one," or even, "Our team is number one." The pronoun is "we," designed to imply the closest possible identity with the team. Note also that nothing similar occurs in the case of failure. No television viewer will ever hear the chant, "We're in last place! We're in last place!" Home team defeats are the times for distancing oneself. Here, "we" is not nearly as preferred as the insulating pronoun "they." To prove the point, I once did a small experiment in which students at Arizona State University were phoned and asked to describe the outcome of a football game their school team had played a few weeks earlier. Some of the students were asked the outcome of a certain game their team had lost. The other students were asked the outcome of a different game, one their team had won. My fellow researcher, Avril Thorne, and I simply listened to what was said and recorded the percentage of students who used the word "we" in their descriptions. When the results were tabulated, it was obvious that the students had tried to connect themselves to success by using the pronoun "we" to describe their school team victory. "We beat Houston 17-14, or "we won." In the case of the lost game, however, "we" was rarely used. Instead, The students used terms designed to keep themselves separate from their vanquished team. They lost to Missouri 30-20, or, I don't know the score, but Arizona State got beat. Perhaps the twin desires to connect ourselves to winners and to distance ourselves from losers were combined consummately in the remarks of one particular student. After dryly recounting the score of the home team defeat, Arizona State lost it 30-20, he blurted in anguish, "They threw away our chance for a national championship." If it is true that to make ourselves look good, we try to bask in the reflected glory of the successes we are even remotely associated with, a provocative implication emerges. We will be most likely to use this approach when we feel that we don't look so good. Whenever our public image is damaged, we will experience an increased desire to restore that image by trumpeting our ties to successful others. At the same time, we will most scrupulously avoid publicizing our ties to failing others. Support for these ideas comes from the telephone study of Arizona State University students. Before being asked about the home team victory or loss, they were given a test of their general knowledge. The test was rigged so that some of the students would fail badly while the others would do quite well. So at the time they were asked to describe the football score, half of the students had experienced recent image damage from their failure of the test. These students later showed the greatest need to manipulate their connections with the football team to salvage their prestige. If they were asked to describe the team defeat, only 17% used the pronoun we in so doing. If, however, they were asked to describe the win, 41% said we. The story was very different, though, for the students who had done well on the general knowledge test. They later used we about equally, whether they were describing a home team victory, 25%, or defeat, 24%. These students had bolstered their images through their own achievement and didn't need to do so through the achievement of others. This finding tells me that it is not when we have a strong feeling of recognized personal accomplishment that we will seek to bask in reflected glory. Instead, it will be when prestige, both public and private, is low that we will be intent upon using the successes of associated others to help restore image. I think it revealing that the remarkable hubbub following the American hockey team victory in the 1980 Olympics came at a time of recently diminished American prestige. The U.S. government had been helpless to prevent both the holding of American hostages in Iran and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It was a time when, as a citizenry, we needed the triumph of that hockey team, and we needed to display or even manufacture our connections to it. We should not be surprised to learn, for instance, that outside the hockey arena, in the aftermath of the win over the Soviet team, scalpers were getting $100 a pair for ticket stubs. Although the desire to bask in reflected glory exists to a degree in all of us, there seems to be something special about people who would wait in the snow to spend $50 apiece for the shreds of tickets to a game they had not attended, presumably to prove to friends back home that they had been present at the big victory. Just what kind of people are they? Unless I miss my guess, they are not merely great sports aficionados. They are individuals with a hidden personality flaw, a poor self-concept. Deep inside is a sense of low personal worth that directs them to seek prestige not from the generation or promotion of their own attainments, but from the generation or promotion of their associations with others of attainment. There are several varieties of this species that bloom throughout our culture. The persistent name-dropper is a classic example. So too is the rock music groupie, who trades sexual favors for the right to tell girlfriends that she was with a famous musician for a time. No matter which form it takes, the behavior of such individuals shares a similar theme. The rather tragic view of accomplishment as deriving from outside the self. Certain of these people work the association principle in a slightly different way. Instead of striving to inflate their visible connections to others of success, they strive to inflate the success of others they are visibly connected to. The clearest illustration is the notorious stage mother, obsessed with securing stardom for her child. Of course, women are not alone in this regard. In 1991, a Davenport, Iowa obstetrician cut off service to the wives of three school officials, reportedly because his son had not been given enough playing time in school basketball games. One of the wives was 8 months pregnant at the time. Physicians' wives often speak of the pressures to obtain personal prestige by association with their husband's professional stature. John Pekkanen, who authored the book The Best Doctors in the U.S., reports that many enraged protests to his list came not from the physicians who were omitted, but from their wives. In one instance that reveals the extent to which the principle of association dominates the thinking of some of these women, Pekkanen received a letter from a frantic wife along with her proof that her husband deserved to be on the list of best doctors. It was a photograph of the man with Merv Griffin. How to say no. Because liking can be increased by many means, a proper consideration of defenses against compliance professionals who employ the liking rule must, oddly enough, be a short one. It would be pointless to construct a horde of specific counter-tactics to combat each of the myriad versions of the various ways to influence liking. There are simply too many routes to be blocked effectively with such a one-on-one strategy. Besides, several of the factors leading to liking—physical attractiveness, familiarity, association—have been shown to work unconsciously to produce their effects on us, making it unlikely that we could muster a timely protection against them. Instead, we need to consider a general approach, one that can be applied to any of the liking-related factors to neutralize their unwelcome influence on our compliance decisions. The secret to such an approach may lie in its timing. Rather than trying to recognize and prevent the action of liking factors before they have a chance to work on us, we might be well advised to let them work. Our vigilance should be directed not toward the things that may produce undue liking for a compliance practitioner, but toward the fact that undue liking has been produced. The time to react protectively is when we feel ourselves liking the practitioner more than we should under the circumstances. By concentrating our attention on the effect rather than the causes, we can avoid the laborious, nearly impossible task of trying to detect and deflect the many psychological influences on liking. Instead, we have to be sensitive to only one thing related to liking in our contacts with compliance practitioners: the feeling that we have come to like the practitioner more quickly or more deeply than we would have expected. Once we notice this feeling, we will have been tipped off that there is probably some tactic being used, and we can start taking the necessary countermeasures. Note that the strategy I am suggesting borrows much from the jiu-jitsu style favored by the compliance professionals themselves. We don't attempt to restrain the influence of the factors that cause liking. Quite the contrary. We allow these factors to exert their force, and then we use that force in our campaign against them. The stronger the force, the more conspicuous it becomes, and consequently the more subject to our alerted defenses. Suppose, for example, we find ourselves bargaining on the price of a new car with Dylan Dan, a candidate for Joe Girard's vacated Greatest Car Salesman title. After talking a while and negotiating a bit, Dan wants to close the deal. He wants us to decide to buy the car. Before any such decision is made, it would be important to ask ourselves a crucial question. In the 25 minutes I've known this guy, have I come to like him more than I would have expected? If the answer is yes, we might want to reflect upon whether Dan behaved during those few minutes in ways that we know affect liking. We might recall that he had fed us coffee and donuts before launching into his pitch, that he had complimented us on our choice of options and color combinations, that he had made us laugh, that he had cooperated with us against the sales manager to get us a better deal. Although such a review of events might be informative, it is not a necessary step in protecting ourselves from the liking rule. Once we discover that we have come to like Dan more than we would have expected to, we don't have to know why. The simple recognition of unwarranted liking should be enough to get us to react against it. One possible reaction would be to reverse the process and actively dislike Dan. But that might be unfair to him and contrary to our own interests. After all, some individuals are naturally likable, and Dan might just be one of them. It wouldn't be right to turn automatically against those compliance professionals who happen to be most likable. Besides, for our own sakes, we wouldn't want to shut ourselves off from business interactions with such nice people, especially when they may be offering us the best available deal. I would recommend a different reaction. If our answer to the crucial question is, yes, under the circumstances, I like this guy peculiarly well, this should be the signal that the time has come for a quick countermaneuver. Mentally separate Dan from that Chevy or Toyota he's trying to sell. It is vital to remember at this point that should we decide for Dan's car, we will be driving it, not him, off the dealership lot. It is irrelevant to a wise automobile purchase that we find Dan likable because he is good-looking, claims an interest in our favorite hobby, is funny, or has relatives back where we grew up. Our proper response, then, is a conscious effort to concentrate exclusively on the merits of the deal and car Dan has for us. Of course, in making a compliance decision, it is always a good idea to keep separate our feelings about the requester and the request. But once immersed in even a brief personal and sociable contact with a requester, that distinction is easy to forget. In those instances, when we don't care one way or the other about a requester, forgetting to make the distinction won't steer us very far wrong. The big mistakes are likely to come when we are fond of the person making a request. That's why it is so important to be alert to a sense of undue liking for a compliance practitioner. The recognition of that feeling can serve as our reminder to separate the dealer from the merits of the deal and to make our decision based on considerations related only to the latter. Were we all to follow this procedure, I am certain we would be much more pleased with the results of our exchanges with compliance professionals, though I suspect that Dylan Dan would not. Reader's Report. From a Chicago Man. Although I've never been to a Tupperware party, I recognized the same kind of friendship pressures recently when I got a call from a long-distance phone company saleswoman. She told me that one of my buddies had placed my name on something called the MCI Friends and Family Calling Circle. This friend of mine, Brad, is a guy I grew up with, but who moved to New Jersey last year for a job. He still calls me pretty regularly to get the news on the guys we used to hang out with from the neighborhood. The saleswoman told me that he can save 20% on all the calls he makes to the people on his calling circle list, provided that they are MCI phone company subscribers. Then she asked me if I wanted to switch to MCI to get all the blah, blah, blah benefits of MCI service, and so that Brad could save 20% on his calls to me. While I couldn't have cared less about the benefits of MCI service, I was perfectly happy with the long-distance company I had. But the part about wanting to save Brad money on our calls really got to me. For me to say that I didn't want to be in his calling circle and didn't care about saving him money would have sounded like a real affront to our friendship when he learned of it. So, to avoid insulting him, I told her to switch me to MCI. I used to wonder why women would go to a Tupperware party just because a friend was holding it, and then buy stuff they didn't want once they were there. I don't wonder anymore. This reader is not alone in being able to testify to the power of the pressures embodied in MCI's calling circle idea. When Consumer Reports magazine inquired into the practice, the MCI salesperson they interviewed was quite succinct. "It works 9 out of 10 times, he said. Chapter 6. Authority. Directed Deference. Follow an Expert. Virgil. Suppose that while leafing through the newspaper, you notice an ad for volunteers to take part in a study of memory being done in the psychology department of a nearby university. Let's suppose further that, finding the idea of such an experiment intriguing, you contact the director of the study, a Professor Stanley Milgram, and make arrangements to participate in an hour-long session. When you arrive at the laboratory suite, you meet two men. One is the researcher in charge of the experiment, as is clearly evidenced by the gray lab coat he wears and the clipboard he carries. The other is a volunteer like yourself, who seems average in all respects. After initial greetings and pleasantries are exchanged, the researcher begins to explain the procedures to be followed. He says that the experiment is a study of how punishment affects learning and memory. Therefore, one participant will have the task of learning pairs of words in a long list until each pair can be recalled perfectly. This person is to be called the learner. The other participant's job will be to test the learner's memory and to deliver increasingly strong electric shocks for every mistake. This person will be designated the teacher. Naturally, you get a bit nervous at this news. And your apprehension increases when, after drawing lots with your partner, you find that you are assigned the learner role. You hadn't expected the possibility of pain as part of the study, so you briefly consider leaving. But no, you think there's plenty of time for that if need be, and besides, how strong a shock could it be? After you have had a chance to study the list of word pairs, the researcher straps you into a chair and, with the teacher looking on, attaches electrodes to your arm. More worried now about the effect of the shock, you inquire into its severity. The researcher's response is hardly comforting. He says that although the shocks can be extremely painful, they will cause you no permanent tissue damage. With that, the researcher and the teacher leave you alone and go to the next room, where the teacher asks you the test questions through an intercom system and delivers electric punishment for every wrong response. As the test proceeds, you quickly recognize the pattern that the teacher follows. He asks the question and waits for your answer over the intercom. Whenever you err, he announces the voltage of the shock you are about to receive and pulls a lever to deliver the punishment. The most troubling thing is that with each error you make, the shock increases by 15 volts. The first part of the test progresses smoothly. The shocks are annoying but tolerable. Later on, though, as your mistakes accumulate and the shock voltages climb, the punishment begins to hurt enough to disrupt your concentration, which leads to more errors and ever more disruptive shocks. At the 75, 90, and 105 volt levels, the pain makes you grunt audibly. At 120 volts, you exclaim into the intercom that the shocks are really starting to hurt. You take one more punishment with a groan and decide that you can't take much more pain. After the teacher delivers the 150-volt shock, you shout back into the intercom, "That's all. Get me out of here. Get me out of here, please. Let me out." But instead of the assurance you expect from the teacher that he and the researcher are coming to release you, the teacher merely gives you the next test question to answer. Surprised and confused, you mumble the first answer to come into your head. It's wrong, of course, and the teacher delivers a 165-volt shock. You scream at the teacher to stop, to let you out. But he responds only with the next test question. And with the next slashing shock when your frenzied answer is incorrect, you can't hold down the panic any longer. The shocks are so strong now, they make you writhe and shriek. You kick the wall, demand to be released, beg the teacher to help you. But the test questions continue as before, and so do the dreaded shocks. In searing jolts of 195, 210, 225, 240, 255, 270, 285, and 300 volts, you realize you can't possibly answer the test correctly now, so you shout to the teacher that you won't answer his questions any longer. Nothing changes. The teacher interprets your failure to respond as an incorrect response and sends another bolt. The ordeal continues in this way until finally the power of the shocks stun you into near paralysis. You can no longer cry out, no longer struggle. You can only feel each terrible electric bite. Perhaps you think this total inactivity will cause the teacher to stop. There can be no reason to continue this experiment. But he proceeds relentlessly, calling out the test questions, announcing the horrid shock levels, about 400 volts now, and pulling the levers. What must this man be like? You wonder in confusion. Why doesn't he help me? Why won't he stop? For most of us, the above scenario reads like a bad dream. To recognize how nightmarish it is, though, we should understand that in most respects it is real. There was such an experiment. Actually, a whole series run by a psychology professor named Milgram, in which participants in the teacher role were willing to deliver continued intense and dangerous levels of shock to a kicking, screeching, pleading other person. Only one major aspect of the experiment was not genuine. No real shock was delivered. The learner, the victim who repeatedly cried out in agony for mercy and release, was not a true subject, but an actor who only pretended to be shocked. The actual purpose of Milgram's study, then, had nothing to do with the effects of punishment on learning and memory. Rather, it involved an entirely different question. When it is their job, how much suffering will ordinary people be willing to inflict on an entirely innocent other person? The answer is most unsettling. Under circumstances mirroring precisely the features of the bad dream, the typical teacher was willing to deliver as much pain as was available to give. Rather than yield to the pleas of the victim, about two-thirds of the subjects in Milgram's experiment pulled every one of the 30 shock switches in front of them and continued to engage the last switch, 450 volts, until the researcher ended the experiment. More alarming still, not one of the 40 subjects in this study quit his job as teacher when the victim first began to demand his release, nor later when he began to beg for it, nor even later when his reaction to each shock had become, in Milgram's words, definitely an agonized scream. Not until the 300-volt shock had been sent and the victim had shouted in desperation that he would no longer provide answers to the memory test did anyone stop, and even then, it was a distinct minority who did. These results surprised everyone associated with the project, Milgram included. In fact, before the study began, he asked groups of colleagues, graduate students and psychology majors at Yale University, where the experiment was performed, to read a copy of the experimental procedures and estimate how many subjects would go all the way to the last 450-volt shock. Invariably, the answers fell to the 1-2% range. A separate group of 39 psychiatrists predicted that only about one person in 1,000 would be willing to continue to the end. No one, then, was prepared for the behavior patterns that the experiment actually produced. How can we explain those alarming patterns? Perhaps, as some have argued, it has to do with the fact that the subjects were all males who are known as a group for their aggressive tendencies, or that the subjects didn't recognize the potential harm that such high shock voltages could cause, or that the subjects were a freakish collection of moral cretins who enjoyed the chance to inflict misery. But there is good evidence against each of these possibilities. First, the subject's sex was shown by a later experiment to be irrelevant to their willingness to give all the shocks to the victim. Female teachers were just as likely to do so as the males in Milgram's initial study. The explanation that subjects weren't aware of the potential physical danger to the victim was also examined in a subsequent experiment and found to be wanting. In that version, when the victim was instructed to announce that he had a heart condition and to declare that his heart was being affected by the shock, "That's all, get me out of here, I told you I had heart trouble. My heart's starting to bother me, I refuse to go on, let me out." The results were the same as before. 65% of the subjects carried out their duties faithfully through the maximum shock. Finally, the explanation that Milgram's subjects were a twisted, sadistic bunch, not at all representative of the average citizen, has proven unsatisfactory as well. The people who answered Milgram's newspaper ad to participate in his memory experiment represented a standard cross-section of ages, occupations, and educational levels within our society. What's more, later on, a battery of personality scales showed these people to be quite normal psychologically, with not a hint of psychosis as a group. They were, in fact, just like you and me. Or as Milgram likes to term it, they are you and me. If he is right that his studies implicate us in their grisly findings, the unanswered question becomes an uncomfortably personal one. What could make us do such things? Milgram is sure he knows the answer. It has to do, he says, with a deep-seated sense of duty to authority within us all. According to Milgram, the real culprit in the experiments was his subject's inability to defy the wishes of the boss of the study, the lab-coated researcher who urged and, if need be, directed the subjects to perform their duties. despite the emotional and physical mayhem they were causing. The evidence supporting Milgram's obedience to authority explanation is strong. First, it is clear that without the researchers' directives to continue, the subjects would have ended the experiment quickly. They hated what they were doing and agonized over their victim's agony. They implored the researcher to let them stop. When he refused, they went on, but in the process they trembled, they perspired, they shook, they stammered protests and additional pleas for the victim's release. Their fingernails dug into their own flesh, they bit their lips until they bled. They held their heads in their hands. Some fell into fits of uncontrollable nervous laughter. As one outside observer to the experiment wrote, "I observed a mature and initially poised businessman enter the laboratory smiling and confident. Within 20 minutes, he was reduced to a twitching, stuttering wreck who was rapidly approaching a point of nervous collapse. He constantly pulled on his earlobe and twisted his hands. At one point, he pushed his fist into his forehead and muttered, 'Oh, God, let's stop it.' And yet he continued to respond to every word of the experimenter and obeyed to the end." In addition to these observations, Milgram has provided even more convincing evidence for the obedience to authority interpretation of his subject's behavior. In a later study, for instance, he had the researcher and the victim switch scripts, so that the researcher told the teacher to stop delivering shocks to the victim, while the victim insisted bravely that the teacher continue. The result couldn't have been clearer. 100% of the subjects refused to give one additional shock when it was merely the fellow subject who demanded it. The identical finding appeared in another version of the experiment, in which the researcher and fellow subject switched roles so that it was the researcher who was strapped into the chair and the fellow subject who ordered the teacher to continue over the protests of the researcher. Again, not one subject touched another shock lever. The extreme degree to which subjects in Milgram's situation were attentive to the wishes of authority was documented in yet another variation of the basic study. In this case, Milgram presented the teacher with two researchers who issued contradictory orders. One ordered the teacher to terminate the shocks when the victim cried out for release, while the other maintained that the experiment should go on.